Oh, let's break for five.
Good afternoon, Board Chair and members of the board. My name is Joelle Geppert. I'm in the Southern Timber Harvest Unit in the Nonpoint Source Division. And it is hard to be the last. However, I think you'll be of interest to see that this program that we're here to talk about today actually brings together a lot of the concepts that have been talked about today. With that, we will be discussing the status of the Mattole Restoration Council's program, Timberlands Environmental Impact Report, and the programmatic timber harvest plans associated with that. With me today is Seth Zuckerman, who's the Forest Futures Project Coordinator for the MRC, and that's part of their Wild and Working Lands program. Today's presentation will give you a brief overview of PTEIRs and PTHPs. Seth will give you some of the nitty-gritty, and then we'll talk briefly about Regional Water Board permitting. So what is a PTEIR? Essentially, a PTEIR is a cumulative impacts assessment of a particular set of activities, timber harvest related activities on a defined area. And in this case, it's for the entire Mattole River watershed. It's a construct of the Forest Practice Rules and has been on the books since 1996. And PTHPs are the tools that implement those set of prescriptions and mitigations. The Mattole PTEIR and PTHP started off as a brainchild at a conference in Sacramento. It was a California Forest Futures conference, and a group of individuals there from the MRC and restoration practitioners and agency personnel been kicking around this idea, decided that this would be a good tool to promote light touch forestry. And they began the process to seek funding for this. And in 2006, the State Water Board funded this project in part through the Proposition 40, the Integrated Watershed Management Program. 2007, the process began, and then just through an MRC and the multi-agency collaboration. Just recently, in September 2011, CAL FIRE, who's the lead agency, certified the PTEIR. And just today, the very first PTHP was filed at CAL FIRE in the Mattole. And we expect that there will be three more PTHPs, and that actually should be January 2012. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Seth.
Switch places, or all right. Well, my name is Seth Zuckerman. Thanks so much, Joelle, for introducing this, and to the board for sticking around till the bitter end here. It's hard being the last on the agenda, but you know, you guys have to sit through the first all the way through the last. I don't have to tell you that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what brought us. A little bit about the Mattole and then what brought us to work on a project like this. You don't often see a restoration group coming in and talking about how we do want to harvest timber. More often you'll hear them talking about how it shouldn't be done. But this is an attempt for us as people with environmental concerns to start using the steering wheel instead of just the brakes. The Mattole watershed, located mostly in Humboldt and with its very headwaters in Mendocino County, about 300 square miles or 190,000 acres, and almost entire vast majority of it is in private hands. So obviously, whatever management practices go on there are going to be determined in part by what's feasible economically and through the regulatory process for these landowners who are managing their lands partly for recreation, partly for aesthetics, but many of them as their source of livelihood. And as you're probably aware, it's been it's the site of one of the longest running citizen-led efforts at watershed restoration, both in the state and up and down the West Coast. Why did we have to embark upon a restoration project? These photos taken from the air near Honeydew will give you a sense. That's what the area looked like in 1942. And I think maybe if we turn off at least some of the lights, if it's not too dangerous to dim lights this late in the day, it'll be easier to see. Thank you. Maybe a little too much. And then in 1965, that's what that same area looked like after unregulated tractor logging with the pressures of the ad valorem tax before the forest practice rules. We have been working in restoration for some time now with a lot of agency partners, including the Water Board. Our work with the Water Board goes back to the late 90s when we first got a 319H contract. And this project, as Joel mentioned, funded through the Integrated Watershed Management Program and Prop 40, which included a whole bunch of other elements that I won't have time to talk about today, stormproofing and road removals, riparian tree planting and invasive species removal, fire hazard reduction, which I'll touch on briefly, as well as water quality monitoring done both by us and our partners, the Matoll Salmon Group, and a project in pumping forbearance that we've worked on with our partner, Sanctuary Forest, where people are given 50,000-gallon storage tanks as a, in return for their promise to not pump out of the headwaters of the river during the dry part of the year. The dilemma we face as we look at forestry practice, which affects, obviously, the recovery of the Matoll, is this. Good forestry, we believe, is good for watershed recovery, because people, as they practice light-touch forestry, are helping the forest mature back to into the kind of habitat that was lost during the post-war round of intensive logging. If people practice light-touch forestry instead of clear-cutting, then the forest, the stands will continue to age, there'll be better habitat. The evapotranspiration demands from these older forests are less than those of young forests, and the fire hazard is less. We believe that the threat of a widespread catastrophic fire is probably one of the greatest threats facing us, both from the standpoint of human habitation and also the recovery of the watershed. But there's a problem, and the problem is that conventional permitting process is stacked against the practice of light-touch forestry. With the cost of a regular timber harvest plan running around $35,000, according to the Buckeye Conservancy and their Buckeye Forest Project, that means that if you spend that much money, you're going to have to that's all going to get paid for by the product you take out of the forest. And in the Matoll, which is mainly a Douglas fir, that's the main commercial species. It's the Douglas fir. Even in a decent market, you're looking at the first 70 truckloads of logs going to pay for that $35,000 cost of a timber harvest plan. And conversely, if people say it's just not worth the hassle, then some of these large landowners are going to look more closely at subdivision selling, and which will lead to further fragmentation of the habitat, more roads in year-round use, more withdrawal of water from the already overtaxed tributaries. So we have a situation where the regulatory scenario is pulling in the exact opposite direction from the outcomes we would like to see. So that's what led us to get involved in this PTEIR. That and the state of the regenerating forests. This dark brown area, those all represent areas that were logged last before 1962. So the age of these stands is 50 years or better, and they're coming up now on commercial viability, meaning that people are going to start looking at logging them again. And we felt like we needed to affect how that logging would take place. As the slide says, it's 38% of the land base that's in this state that's growing into commercial maturity. And what we recognize, too, is that there's been a lull recently because of the timber gap of age classes, where there has been very little logging in the last 10 or 15 years. But we don't expect that's going to continue. And so what the PTEIR offers is a bargain to the landowner. In exchange for practicing lighter touch forestry, you'll have access to this streamlined permitting system through the PTEIR. Joel mentioned that our first plan was accepted for filing today at CAL FIRE. This is what the plan looks like. And about a third of that is the archaeological report, some maps. A lot of it is a checklist that people just check off boxes. And so the idea is that we'll be able to bring the cost of a plan down from, say, $35,000 to more on the range of $12,000 to $15,000. And the hope is that that will be the incentive that helps to bring people towards a practice of light-touch forestry. For people who don't yet have commercially viable loggable stands, we also have a cost share program that's also been funded in part by our grant from the Water Board to help people with the cost of pre-commercial thinning and limbing that will reduce the fire hazard on those stands. That's a shaded fuel break in there. So the PTER carries advantages for both sides. From the standpoint of environmental review, the PTER itself, I didn't bring that because that's not as slender as the PTHP I just showed. It's a little over 500 pages. The effects of the forestry prescriptions and associated road work and yarding was analyzed thoroughly based standing on the shoulders of the TMDL that was written for the Mattole. And it's always struck me, and I think because we're looking at it at a watershed scale, we're able to assess cumulative effects on a more appropriate scale. It's always struck me as a little odd that people try to assess cumulative effects on the scale of THP by THP when inherently the effects are cumulative and the effect of the aggregate of all those plans. So this is a chance to make those two scales coincide. For the landowner, as I mentioned, the advantages are the lower cost, the checklist format. There's shorter review time for these because the plans actually don't go to second review. There's a first review and then a pre-harvest inspection and then a consultation among the various agencies about what the findings were out in the field. And the main question that they consider together is whether the PTHP is within the scope of what the PTEIR contemplated. So the questions are a lot narrower, the process, we believe, will take less time and cost less. I'll talk more about this geologic hazards flowchart. One of the main constraints on logging in the Mattole, because the terrain is so unstable, is the areas of unstable geology. And we've developed, as part of the PTEIR, a set of flowcharts that steer foresters without having to enlist the more expensive consultation of a geologist, steer foresters into an avoidance strategy so that they can structure their logging plans to avoid the areas that would be of concern for mass wasting and water quality. Now, of course, on the scale of an entire watershed, you can't review all of the specifics that you would need to know about each site. And so each PTHP is reviewed individually, both by CAL FIRE and the public trust agencies, including water quality. CAL FIRE consults with the other agencies and holds a pre-harvest inspection, same as it would with a THP. In the course of preparing the PTHP, the forester has to identify sediment sources, prepare an erosion control plan, and after the plan is approved, they can seek a waiver of the WDRs. So they are definitely still under the umbrella of water quality regulation. And of course, the submitters have to provide all the other site-specific surveys for endangered species, rare plants, and archaeology. Talk a little bit about what you won't find in our PTEIR, and that includes clear cuts. It includes the use of herbicides. That's what all these dead trees are. These are trees that were killed, hardwoods that were killed to restore land to conifer forest on an industrial plan. And this is also a different kind of even age management. This is either a seed tree step or a shelterwood seed step, preparatory to establishing a new stand and cutting down all those remaining trees. What you will find in our PTEIR, individual tree selection, group selection with up to 1 acre openings, and at the with slightly larger openings can also be made as long as some structure and legacy, some trees are left behind. What makes it light touch from our point of view is that the land, even after it's harvested, remains in forest cover. It's still a forest, a maturing forest that is getting bigger and older. The way we achieve those is by setting some other parameters on the kind of harvesting they can do, leaving 60 to 70% of the basal area, leaving half of the largest trees, and a requirement that from one entry to the next, the remaining timber inventory after harvest has to continue to increase until it reaches a plateau that's a couple about twice as great as what would be required under individual tree selection. I'll just run through a few simulation slides that show how a stand would develop under this kind of management. You can see this is a top view. The lighter green are hardwoods and the darker green are conifers, a side view, and the views it might look from the hillside across the creek. This is in 2005 when the simulation begins. 10 years later, after there's been a harvest in between, another 20 years go by, and so on. This is an example of what the stand would look like after one of the entries, the selective harvest entries, and you can get a sense of how many trees are lying on the ground after logging, but how many still remain standing. A variety of specific constraints in the PTEIR, and I should say that this was developed with a wide range of public input, and that's one of the reasons that it took us a long time to do this, both as a citizen organization that takes input from our membership and the community. We went through a couple of rounds with some of the local stakeholders to develop all of these criteria. So trees that were sprouted before 1850 are not fair game under the PTEIR. You can't build more than 1,000 feet of new road per PTHP unless you can justify it as being of lower impact than reusing a road that's in a really bad spot that you're going to retire. And there are limits, of course, based on the geological setting. We have wider no-cut buffers than even under the anadromous salmon rules, 75 feet on a Class 1 and 30 feet on a Class 2. And we have canopy retention standards on Class 3s that are aimed at keeping the hill slopes stable. That's also why there's no patch cuts allowed in those stream zones. Finally, on slopes greater than 65% leading right down to a stream, those are also no-cut areas. We're, again, standing on the shoulders of other work that's been done in the Mattole already. This was a map that was made for the North Coast Watershed Assessment Program, NICWAP, and the red areas were rated by the California Geologic Survey as a very high landslide hazard risk. The orange areas, or yellow, rated as a high landslide hazard. And so areas like this and areas that are on mapped features that have previously been mapped by the Geologic Survey, those lead foresters into a flow chart, which asks them a series of questions that they can answer just with their own forestry training without having to resort to hiring a geologist, where they can look for geomorphic indicators of slope instability, and that will lead them either to more restrictive prescriptions or to the regular PTEIR prescriptions or to some that have, or to no-cut areas based on wanting to avoid the risk of mass wasting. There's one flow chart for silviculture, and there's another for yarding and another for road building. We've wondered a lot we wanted to wrestle the question of who would participate in this. We did a survey early on and found that roughly half the landowners and the vast majority of those who own 160 acres or more would be interested in harvesting timber at some point. And of those who are interested in logging, 75% of these family landowners said that the PTEIR was of interest to them. We did a feasibility analysis based on economics and on various projections of fluctuating log prices and satellite analysis or remote sensing data of what the vegetative cover is actually like and how large the trees are. We estimate that about 70 landowners will use it over the next couple of decades. That includes 15 with under 160 acres, so a few of the smaller landowners, and 55 of owners of greater than 160 acres. That's about 35% or so of the landowners in that size category. Although the PTEIR has been in the forest practice rule since 1996, there's only been three PTEIRs approved before this one. One of them on the Hearst Corporation's land in northeastern California, and two of them on multi-owner tracts. Neither of those has actually been used. And so we were concerned that we didn't want to do all this work and make sure that it's and let it sit on a shelf. So we're on contract also to shepherd the first four PTHPs through the process and to do a training for foresters so that it's widely known as an option and it's a tested option for people to use in the Mattole. Of course, it's not just CAL FIRE that regulates the harvesting of timber. Water quality has a hand in it as well. And since this whole strategy of encouraging light touch forestry rests on making permitting easier for those who choose lighter touch, that's why we're looking for comprehensive coverage and trying to figure out how this will fit with the waiver of WDRs through water quality. Because the silviculture in our PTEIR is comparable to that in a modified THP, which already qualifies for a waiver, except for the area limitation, which in a modified THP is 100 acres or less. And after looking at it at some length, we determined that it was compatible with the Category F of the existing waiver. The only place where there's a divergence is that we've provided this flow chart as a streamlined way of addressing the possibility of logging on unstable areas. And we did an analysis to determine whether it resulted in comparable outcomes to what would be available under a Note 45 report, and it does. So just to sum up, we're looking at this PTEIR as a way of providing a range of benefits, ways of an incentive to grow the forest into the kind of condition we think would be beneficial, ecologically speaking, to reduce fire hazard, to provide income for landowners. It will provide an incentive for them to retain their land in large unfragmented blocks. And, of course, in this climate where the availability of taxpayer funding to support water quality improvements is getting less and less every year, each harvest will itself, through the revenue generated, fund the necessary road upgrades and elements of the erosion control plan. So I just want to say thanks to all of our partners, the State Water Board, which has provided the funding, Michelle Fortner and her colleague Diana Henriul, who worked with us on this contract, as well as Janet Blake, since retired, Joelle, Mark, and Matt, who continue to work with us, and Bob Clamp, who did before, and the Bella Vista Foundation, one of our other funders. So with that, we'll turn it back over to Joelle, who has a few other concluding remarks.
This is probably one of the most interesting portions for the board, permitting. We have four pilot projects that we'll be looking at, and we have been anticipating these for quite some time. And we were looking at the various options available for us, which are use of our general WDR, creating new WDRs, creating a new waiver category, or use of our existing categorical waiver. And obviously the most efficient use of staff time was to see how either the criteria in the categorical waiver was compatible with the prescriptions in the PTEIR, and or how we can help make those compatible with our waiver. And that's what we've done, is we've worked with the MRC to ensure that these PTHPs that are coming through are compatible with the criteria of our existing categorical waiver. There are some slight variations with the canopy conditions. However, we have an alternative allowed underneath the waiver that we can justify using the environmental impact report. And then this issue of flowcharts as a geologic equivalent of a Note 45. There are some operations that will be allowed on areas that have mapped geomorphic indicators of instabilities, not necessarily landslides or instabilities, or unstable areas. And what we have worked with the MRC and their geologist on is demonstrating that the flowcharts and the analysis associated with them is essentially a geologic report. So we feel that we have got a good foundation there, that we have an equivalent process and a compatible program. So In the future, we may even recommend that we look at this as an approach to any future modifications to our existing categorical waiver, so we can incorporate more areas and promote, you know, lighter touch forestry. And I think that's all, unless you have any questions.
Thanks. Yeah. I've got a couple. This is great to see. I had the privilege of meeting with Seth maybe 6 months ago or so, and he introduced me to the concept, and it was on the heels of our workshop for the NTMP folks, and I was really encouraged to hear about this program and some applicability that it has, some options that it could provide for that community. I don't know if Matt has been, you know, maybe this is the first time Matt's heard of this. I don't suspect it is, but, you know, that I'd like to think that there's some opportunities that we can provide some crosswalks, particularly in the idea, and I think, Seth, you kind of hit this home in the very beginning, and it was stressed to us with the private landowners for the NTMPs, is that with increasing regulation, there's increased cost, and with the increased cost, then to cover those costs, there's more trees cut. And it almost gets away from the philosophy and the approach of the NTMP. And, you know, when we were standing out with Pete Busman, he held up a picture of his property, and he also had a picture of a clear cut, and he said, "You guys tell me what you want. I got to cover my costs. I got to do this. So, you know, whatever you prescribe, it's going to look one way or the other." And I'm delivering the gist of what his message was. I'm not saying it exactly how he said it, but you get the idea. So it seems that there may be some methods here that might actually help reduce costs for those folks in that program. And I'd like to see a way that if, you know, we can blend those two to maybe offer up some solutions there. I think that would be really great. I know we've been working forward collaboratively with those folks for the NTMP. So if any opportunity we can bring in some of these ideas, whether they be fresh or repeated, I think that would be great. With respect to the Note 45 and the flowchart, I like the flowchart idea. You kind of went over it quickly. Is the State Board of Geology on board with that in terms of using that as a surrogate for a Note 45 report?
The California Geologic Survey, Jim Falls and Gerald Marshall helped us develop the flowchart.
The flowchart?
Yeah.
And so, which is great. And then in terms of now for the folks that you actually have to submit that report to that would be reviewing that information, is that working with them? Or has it gone through one round of review at California Geological Survey?
Yes, in the sense that they have participated in the development. They've been consulted with under the PTEIR process.
Okay.
And we should probably point out that under the flow chart, there are pathways, if you choose to go more aggressively, will lead you to needing to get a more in-depth report. So the use of the flowcharts doesn't, all paths don't lead you to not having to do a report. Does that make sense?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, it's not a way of skirting around having to do the work. I recognize
right.
that.
And if you want to stick with the lighter touch prescriptions that the flowchart recommends, mm-hmm. that are the conservative approach, basically, then you're fine. But if you want to try to go beyond that conservative envelope, then you have to get a geologist to look at it more in more detail.
Sure.
I'm not sure if I fully got your question about the participation of CGS in this, but...
Well, I think in terms of the development that they were involved, but then in terms of, okay, we helped you prepare this as a means to do it. Now you've taken it, you've done it, and you've submitted one. And have they said, oh, yeah, this actually works?
Well, we expect them on the PHIs mm-hmm. for these PTHPs as they're filed. And I know the first one has the flowchart. You know, they work through the flowcharts in it.
Right.
So, you know, that's where the rubber's going to meet the road.
Yeah. And that PHI hasn't happened yet.
Right.
Because
it was
filed.
Just accepted for filing today.
Got it. That answered my question. And then I guess lastly for my questions, I have two. Is there thoughts for doing some monitoring for looking at the success of the light touch? I mean, conceptually, clearly for, you know, in terms of cumulative effects and looking rather than on a THP-specific basis, you're looking at a watershed-wide basis. But, you know, just what are your thoughts on or your approach there?
Definitely. Part of what we're putting together is a methods manual for mm-hmm. monitoring so that landowners can do a lot of it themselves. But on the first set of pilot PTHPs, we're doing some more elaborate monitoring. So we have some temperature loggers that we put in already this year to collect baseline data. And then we have, through working with Tom Lyle from Redwood Sciences Lab, we developed a system where we're going to monitor the the head wall of each class three and see whether it migrates farther up the channel or up the swale as a result of cutting. That would be another proxy. And then, like I say, photo monitoring at places where we are concerned that there might be some kind of mass movement.
Great. Well, I was pleased to hear your presentation, and I like the idea of a lot of those potential cost-saving efforts that could be applied specifically for NTMP folks. And so I'd be encouraged to see how we can make that work. And clearly it's been vetted through certain levels of other agencies. And so hopefully that could crosswalk over as a potential option. So I look forward to hearing a little bit more on that and as the program moves forward.
Could I make one more point I forgot
sure.
to point out, which was when you get an opportunity, because there's obviously a lot in this program, it's pretty large and all-encompassing. If you have time, I would suggest you check out the cumulative watershed effects, particularly with regards to sediment impacts, because it was done pretty differently. It's a unique approach than is typically done in cumulative impact assessment, and it actually looks at if the projected number of plans are implemented over a given time, the improvements to water quality and TMDL compliance. It's pretty in depth and kind of complex to talk about in a nutshell, but it's pretty interesting.
Where do we find it?
You'll find the whole PTEIR on the Mattole Restoration's website, which is mattole.org.
Okay, both on our website and on CAL FIRE's.
Okay. Thanks.
There's a link to it in the EOSR.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Any other board members?
And yep. That said, any other questions?
Yeah, Mr. Can I ask you just a few just for my own edification, because I just had some questions here. On the second to last page, actually, of the yellow section, it talks about just the conditions, no clear cutting, even age management, and it says a Mattole specific all age prescription has been developed and is similar to transition prescription under the
right.
And can you just elaborate on that? What does that
sure.
mean?
The all age because so much of the Mattole was first logged before the Zeeburg-Nedgedly Act required replanting of conifers, a lot of it has shifted more to a hardwood-dominated landscape. And some landowners want to make the investment in bringing that back to shifting the balance back towards conifers. The all-age prescription was developed by one of the foresters who was on the team writing the PTEIR, and it basically allows for the creation of small openings and planting them. Typically, the sort of more industrial prescription would be a rehabilitation cut that would lay bare a lot more ground all at the same time. So the idea in this is that small openings of up to 20% would be created, and then some thinning could be done in between those patches. And then the openings would have to be planted. And then to determine from CAL FIRE standards whether the ground is stocked, you could count either a pre-existing tree based on its basal area, or you could count the seedlings that you had as long as they were free to grow, and you'd have to have a plan for continuing to keep at least some of your crop trees, to keep your crop trees released so that they can make it through the canopy.
Okay, great. And this falls under, as it is right now, this falls under a category of the waiver as it is right now, correct? And you provided some discussion about the fact that it may be advantageous. In fact, it talks about it in here a bit, just to make a specific, either program to this or fit it under this, and or make a switch to the, or an amendment maybe to the existing waiver. It seems like it would be the latter that would be, from a staff standpoint and from just a resource standpoint here, that from making something that is viable, instead of making a whole new program to fit it under something that's mm-hmm. existing. But is that an odd fit right now because this category, what is it, category F?
Yes.
I'm sorry. And is that a good fit for it? Is that not right?
Well, we've had a lot of discussions over the past 18 months and looking at how we're not certain how many THPs there are going to be under this program, any PTHPs. So we're looking at using the existing categorical waiver, whether or not these PTHPs that were coming through would be compliant with that. And as it turns out, they will be. And so we're kind of writing out a bit of the time frame of the existing waiver and looking to see how many PTHPs start coming through to kind of balance the staff work necessary to either have a MATOL specific module that we could amend into the existing categorical waiver, or if that time frame comes up that it's going to coincide with renewing the waiver or rewriting that, whether how we approach that, whether or not we incorporate lessons learned from the MATOL PTAR as a general category, or if we have a specific module, or sort of how that comes about based on what the workload appears to actually be. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, just from the standpoint, it sounds like it's rather fluid, and you've put some thought into this, and you and your unit.
A lot.
Yeah, sounds like it.
And I think that likely, I think that the category, as long as, since we've established this crosswalk between the flowcharts and the Note 45 process that's in the existing waiver, I think that at least for the remainder of the waiver, the lifetime of the current waiver, I think that there's a good chance that it should fit pretty well under Category F, and then it might just make it, you know, then you can reopen the question when it comes time to write the new waiver.
And Seth, you mentioned that you thought there may be 70 landowners out here that could take advantage of this program and use it. So you're just, it sounds like this is just starting to, you know, the first one's in, you got three more coming maybe, and potentially there's 66 more out there or something like that, huh?
Over the next, I mean, that's, yeah. You know, the modeling, you have to come up with some estimate of how much it's going to be used, and that was one of the biggest challenges in doing a multi-landowner PTEIR is you don't have management authority over the land. You just have to make a guess of what landowners are going to want to do, and that's going to depend on market conditions as well as the cost of hauling. So you develop a model, which is what we did. And that's what that model suggests over the next 20 years, that we might see 70 landowners take advantage of it, and then some of them would repeat again, you know, because a lot of the land would be on a cutting cycle of every 15 or 20 years.
Thanks.
Okay. No speaker cards, nothing from the public? All right. Thanks, guys.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Last but not least.